Today we are discussing the identification and management of patients with somatisation in primary care with Associate Professor Hamish Wilson from the Department of General Practice, Dunedin School of Medicine, University of Otago, and co-author of Being a Doctor. Hamish, could you start by outlining what is meant by the term somatisation and how you approach these patients in primary care?
Well, thanks, Mark, for the opportunity to talk about this group of patients, because they can be quite troubling to us as doctors, and there are some very good reasons why that is the case. I guess I'm motivated by the fact that many of these patients, especially the more chronic ones, can be suffering quite badly and they can lose hope in terms of getting better. So briefly then, many patients have symptoms but no disease, at least as understood within our traditional medical framework. Symptoms are usually caused by maladaptive functioning of an organ system, but without underlying tissue or organ damage. And sometimes symptoms can also be quite out of proportion to the underlying cause, such as people with chronic pain. And it's confusing at the moment because many terms are now being used to describe these conditions, such as functional somatic symptoms, or functional illness, or somatization, medically unexplained symptoms, MUS, and so on. Older terms are psychosomatic illness, while a new one now is bodily distress syndrome, or BDS. In this podcast, these terms are used interchangeably in a more general way, rather than trying to differentiate between them. Some people use the term mind-body, which refers to the links between the brain and the body, or human physiology. And this term means different things to different people. Some of the links are from the conscious mind to the body, but there are also links from the subconscious parts of the brain or the brainstem that are not under the same voluntary control. More accurately, the mind and the body are not actually separate, but indivisible, but that is a conceptual leap for many of us. So these symptoms and syndromes can be quite complex. They also vary from patient to patient, and unfortunately they are poorly conceptualised within the medical model, which makes life difficult for both patients and for us doctors and other health professionals. My own preference is to not use medically unexplained symptoms as a label, as this is more of a research term than a clinical one. It doesn't say what the problem actually is, it only says what it's not. And most patients are really wanting an explanation. They don't want us to say that it's unexplained. Actually, I believe we can explain most of these symptoms now. So in terms of labels, my own preference is for functional symptoms or functional illness, meaning that the problem is due to how an organ system is functioning, but there is no underlying structural damage. And this is why x-rays and tests are usually negative. These symptoms are very common, both in primary care and in specialist clinics. And we see symptoms that cannot be explained by a readily recognised disease. And this is up to 10 to 20% of all consultations. Many of these cases in general practice are self-limiting and resolved by themselves. For this reason, time is very useful in primary care. And in these situations, our role is quite straightforward and includes reassuring the patient and providing symptom relief. A minority of patients, however, continue to experience ongoing symptoms, often leading to lots more consultations and multiple tests, which in turn cause more anxiety and expense, and as well can turn up incidental findings or false positive results. When these sorts of symptoms remain mysterious, both patients and their doctors can feel frustrated and helpless, which can be quite difficult to handle. For doctors, it is often very helpful to talk such patients over with colleagues or in a peer group or in supervision or whatever, as this helps us to gain perspective and not to get too tied up in endless tests or blaming the patient, actions that are usually in response to not feeling so effective as usual. Actually, I think this is a very interesting field at the moment, as recent advances in neurophysiology and the concept of neuroplasticity are now proving quite useful. We can improve our management of these patients by recognising the role of the brainstem in creating inappropriate, or what you might call hypersensitive, neurophysiological pathways that's back and forth between the brainstem and body tissues in physiology. Importantly, the brainstem is not under immediate voluntary or conscious control, but it is often influenced by a wide range of biological and psychosocial factors, all of which can interact to cause these unexplained symptoms. In my experience, the key approach to effective clinical management is to provide a readily understandable explanation for the patient who is often seeking recognition and validation of their symptoms. However, unless the patient trusts the doctor, they will not usually accept the explanations on offer. In order for the patient to trust the doctor must get to know and respect the patient. So I think it's really helpful to develop a range of explanations for various clinical situations and different sorts of patients. For example, links between mind and body, the brain, what I call the brainstem talk, fight, flight, physiology, and so on. These explanations help to create empathic narratives for the patients that acknowledge their illness experience. And then detailed explanations are then the starting point for a broad approach to patient care, as well as to reduce the potential for iatrogenic harm. I'd like to add that everyone has their own ideas about these difficult areas of clinical practice. I have been exploring this area for many years as I find it a fascinating window into the nature of medical practice and who we are as doctors, but these concepts here are just my own understanding at the moment. I'd also like to acknowledge the pioneering work from Professor Brian Broom in Auckland and Dr. Brett Mann in Christchurch, who have led the way in New Zealand at least in terms of better recognition and treatment of patients with these particular illnesses. So we are indebted to their contributions over the last 20 to 30 years. And more recently, Mr. John Dunbar from Dunedin in orthopaedics and Dr. Rod Duncan in Christchurch in neurology are providing clinical leadership.
Do you have any key points that you can provide to other general practitioners who are managing patients with functional illness?
Well, I have five key points followed by some practical and what I hope are useful tips. I think these illnesses need to be considered as formal illnesses in their own right, rather than something that's not a legitimate disease. And most of us practicing doctors were not taught about these illnesses in medical school, so it's not surprising that we can find it hard to identify the problem or offer practical advice to patients. It's a bit like learning medicine in English, but then some patients seem to be speaking a different language, like French or German. I think it takes time and energy to develop some of these different sorts of skills that are required. And similarly for patients, it can take time and energy for them to recover. And just as in many other diseases, you know, perhaps like diabetes, their own self-management is often the key. And fifthly, there's now a wide range of explanatory models that you can tailor for different patients. Our job is to give them a package of ideas and options that collectively might be effective. In terms of tips, the first is that some people's symptoms may improve or even resolve with a simple, well-timed explanation, but many require much more detailed explanations over several consultations. Education about what is going on is a key part of management, and rather than trying to fully educate such patients on the tail end of the usual 15-minute multi-agenda consultation, it may be a good idea to suggest a longer, dedicated time and flag that idea in advance. And that time can be useful to learn more about the patient as a person, who they are, what sort of life and background they have had, what's on their plate at the moment, and so on. Some patients with chronic or ongoing symptoms can feel quite isolated and marginalised and may have felt judged or criticised by others, even including their family. So we do need to tread carefully at times if we are to get them on side. I think it's useful to remind patients that having bouts of symptoms means their body and their organs are structurally okay and functioning just fine for most of the time. Bouts of symptoms means that at other times their internal body system controlling that organ is a bit out of balance or overreacting in some way, a bit like the carburetor in a car being set too high or the heat pump being on the wrong setting. Importantly, these symptoms are not under voluntary control. They usually involve these regional neurophysiological pathways. Patients cannot stop these symptoms happening, and once triggered, they're very difficult to turn off. Having said that, it is possible to help patients find ways to reduce or even prevent their symptoms from occurring. And following on from that, realising that symptoms are not under voluntary control helps us as health professionals to avoid feeling impatient or frustrated with the patient, feelings that are quite common for us. I think both the patient and the doctor may be looking for a simple answer, such as a drug or surgery, but by definition, these illnesses can be quite complex. So single and simple interventions may not be effective. I think it's best to try these ideas out on a younger person with a new illness rather than tackling your most long-standing chronic pain patient as a first attempt. In terms of drug treatment, avoiding narcotics is a general rule, or reduce them if at all possible. Symptomatic relief is better than an escalating ladder of pain medications. There are quite a few community groups and websites and apps that can be very helpful. And interestingly, there are many stories now of patients recovering from long-standing illnesses using these community-based self-management techniques. Those patients with chronic pain need a primer about the difference between acute pain from damaged tissues and chronic pain, where minor stimuli can be misinterpreted by the brainstem as pain. I think metaphors are useful. In chronic pain, for example, the incoming signals are overreacted to by the brainstem. It's a bit like having a house 10 metres from the railway line, where initially it sounds like the train is about to crash into your living room. But over time, as you trust that the train will stay on the tracks, the noise of the train seems less, and after more time, you don't hear it at all. Most of the symptoms of functional illness are due to the brainstem overreacting in this sort of way, well-intentioned, but a bit irritating and misguided at times. And when people have a lot on their plate, then their fight-flight response is slightly on all the time, and people are a bit jumpy. They're more likely to have bouts of their functional symptoms at such times. And conversely, when they relax on holiday, their symptoms can be a bit better. So these patterns of increase and reduction in symptoms illustrate the importance of the parasympathetic system, the one that damps down the fight-flight response. And once patients have been told about this system and they understand its purpose, then they can more readily accept the rationale for rest and relaxation and quiet walks and meditation and so on. So these activities are all useful adjuncts to the more focused explanation about the nature of, say, chronic pain and how to reduce specific symptoms.
What sort of symptoms might be considered as part of functional illness?
Well, there's lots of symptoms that might be due to somatization or functional illness. In the field of orthopedics, for example, there's chronic pain and complex regional pain syndrome and fibromyalgia. In cardiology, there's non-cardiac chest pain, which is very common. People turning up to ED with chest pain, but only a small percentage of patients actually have cardiac disease. There's also shortness of breath and palpitations and collapse and fainting attacks and blackouts. Neurology is an interesting field because there's lots of what you call functional neurological disorder, chronic headache, non-epileptic or dissociative seizures, paresthesias, weakness of an arm or leg, difficulty walking, shaking or tremor. Two patients of mine I know were in remission from cancer, but actually a bit later developed unusual neurological symptoms. Those symptoms didn't fit the usual pattern and both had what is known as functional neurological disorder. In gastroenterology, there's abdominal pain and nausea and vomiting and irritable bowel syndrome and so on. Gynecology, there's chronic pelvic pain, recurring urinary symptoms, sexual problems and so on. ENT, dizziness, recurrent sore throat, dysphagia. I remember I had a patient, a 45-year-old woman, who collapsed while on holiday, admitted to hospital in another country. When she came back, we reviewed all her notes and found she'd been investigated and for multiple symptoms in many different specialties and no cause found. So many patients have symptoms in many different organ systems. So any symptom really in any organ system can be one of these particular illnesses.
Is functional illness something that can be clearly diagnosed, or is it more of a concept that is useful to explain the presence of symptoms when an identifiable disease is absent?
Well, in my view, functional illness is a diagnosis and needs to be legitimised as a disease in its own right. So just as a bit of background here, medical students are given various mnemonics to remember all the various types of diseases. So one mnemonic that we use at Otago is a vindicated PI, and it covers all the underlying possible causes, such as A for anoxia and V for vascular and I for inflammatory. And then there's neoplastic, degenerative, intoxication, congenital, autoimmune, traumatic, endocrine, dietary, psychiatric like schizophrenia or psychological such as major depression or anorexia. And then there's iatrogenic caused by doctor's interventions. But somehow in these traditional lists at least, functional illness or somatization were usually not included. I believe most of these patients don't have psychiatric disorder, so they don't fit under the P for psychiatric or psychological. So in our teaching at Otago, we are looking to expand this list to include functional symptoms. So the mnemonic is now a vindicated PFI, as in our view, functional illness needs to be part of the differential diagnosis at the first consultation. So this might help prevent the usual process of investigating until nothing is found, and only then considering the possibility of somatization as an afterthought. Now, as it turns out, most of these illnesses are quite individual and unique to a particular patient, but lots of these illnesses do have quite common patterns, and there are now some quite good diagnostic criteria that can help us to make a positive diagnosis. These criteria, a bit like the old-fashioned criteria for rheumatic heart disease, you know, there's major and minor criteria. So you have to check those lists to see if the patient fits sufficiently. I'm thinking about complex syndromes now, such as chronic fatigue syndrome or ME, complex regional pain syndrome or CRIPS, functional neurological disorders such as gait or tremor problems or non-epileptic seizures, irritable bowel syndrome with the Rome criteria, fibromyalgia, migraine headache with or without aura, and so on. So these criteria are quite well established now, and they've helped to legitimise these illnesses. So yes, these illnesses and syndromes can be clearly diagnosed, as long as we don't limit ourselves to the old-fashioned dualistic model of either physical or psychiatric causes of disease.
What are the challenges that clinicians face in the diagnosis and treatment of patients with functional illness?
Well, these patients don't fit our usual expected patterns in medical practice of organ-based disease, which is usually based on biological plausibility and a single cause and effect relationship. You know, blocked arteries in the heart cause angina, narrow airways due to allergic responses cause asthma, low insulin causes diabetes, and so on. So biological plausibility is the method of reasoning we use to establish a cause and effect relationship between a biological factor and a particular disease. So the metaphor in Western medicine, at least, is a sort of a biomechanical one. It's a bit like your car not starting. You check the battery and then the fuel tank, then the carburetor and the spark plugs, all the usual mechanical reasons why the car won't start. Or if it does, it sort of splutters its way down the street. You know, that body as machine metaphor has been very useful, actually, in developing our understanding of the human body. And we all now benefit from the advances in anaesthesia and drug treatment and surgical techniques and so on. But of course, human beings are not really like a motor car. We're much more complex, and our bodies often reflect what's going on in our lives. As an example, we all know and accept the placebo response, where symptoms can get better without with just a sugar tablet or even sham surgery in about 30% of cases. But we don't necessarily take that insight to challenge the body as machine metaphor. We don't take that further. And there's lots of six-year-olds, for example, who tell mummy they've got a sore tummy and don't want to go to school today, which is okay. But after several days of this, most mothers ask a couple of questions like, have you been going to the toilet properly? And many of them also instinctively ask, what's going on at school, sweetheart? Is someone being mean to you? So these mums do a sort of quick differential diagnosis that includes constipation and somatizing symptoms. The trouble is that abdominal pain in relation to feeling scared is not so easy to explain in terms of tissues or cells or biological causes like we're used to in the biomedical model. But those links are easier to accept if we acknowledge that our bodies can reflect what is going on for us in the world. And it's not that those internal organs are damaged. It seems that at times or on bounce, they just don't seem to work properly, or they overwork and give us pain. So that's how the term functional illness arose. It's how the body's functioning. In brief, then, these sorts of illnesses disrupt our usual medical narrative, which is symptoms to examination to investigations and to diagnosis and treatment. So this disjunction between our expectations of what we should be encountering and what we actually see can be quite disconcerting, one of the reasons why we can struggle with these patients. As an aside here, I remember when I was doing my obstetrics in the 1980s, and I was working in a very dysfunctional hospital at the time. There was a lot of unprofessional behaviour going on, and there was considerable tension and strain between staff. I started to get bouts of abdominal pain. I wasn't very good at that time in making an accurate self-diagnosis, but my flatmates at the time instantly recognised that it was related to a very stressful work situation. It's interesting that they hadn't been socialised in the same way that I had been into the medical model, and they had no difficulty in seeing the links. In terms of specific courses for developing diagnostic and treatment skills, Brian Broom in Auckland has run mind-body or whole-person-focused educational courses for health professionals for many years now. He suggests that clinicians need sustained education to move past what he calls the typical Western healthcare dualistic view of patients with physical disease to a more non-dualistic whole-person understanding of health and illness. He says it takes time and practice and support and ongoing supervision for such skills to be used more comfortably in clinical settings. The corollary, of course, is that without such retraining, many of us doctors inevitably find these patients to be quite challenging, at least initially. I am a bit of an optimist, however. I think picking up these skills is quite achievable through good discussion and peer groups and at well-focused CME sessions. And the postgraduate courses from the University of Otago that my colleagues and I have been running here for many years can also be a very helpful introduction to understanding these patients and how to be more effective with them.
Can you consider functional illness at the first consultation? And if so, when should clinicians have an increased suspicion of functional illness?
Well, there is a growing realisation now that functional symptoms can and should be considered at the first consultation. There are usually quite a few clues, and these illnesses usually have a pattern to them, just like other diseases like heart failure or asthma have their own particular pattern. It's useful to explore the nature of the symptoms, which are often in bouts, as I've said. Now, medical students use another mnemonic called Socrates to explore the characteristics of pain or other symptoms, which is site, onset, character, radiation, associations, time course, exacerbating or relieving factors, and severity. So the character of the pain or symptom is often a strong sign, and most doctors intuitively realise that a particular chest pain, for example, is not cardiac in origin. And often there are no other symptoms or signs on examination for that particular body system that you're looking at. And quite often the patient has had a previous history of similar symptoms or others that were not explained, so it's very useful to ask them what they thought about those bouts in retrospect, as this gives you some clues about their own internal explanations and personal styles. The time correlation of symptoms with life events and issues is a very helpful question, not only in terms of the original onset, but also in terms of when it flares up, say at work, or settles down, say in the weekends or on holidays. Pain or symptoms can also be quite out of proportion to the contributing event, or do not improve with time after only a minor trigger. Some illnesses like complex regional pain syndrome also have inflammatory or autonomic symptoms and signs like redness and swelling, which is a giveaway. Paresthesias or pains that don't fit the usual innervations of peripheral nerves are likely to be a functional illness rather than an anatomical one. I saw a patient recently with tingling sensations around the tragus of the ear and on her face, which doesn't fit the usual distribution of cranial nerves. So it is possible to make a positive diagnosis at the first presentation, although not every time, of course. The most important thing is to consider functional illness at the same time as other diseases and to try and rule it in and to try and rule it out, just in the same way as we do for all the other possible disease categories. And if we are transparent about this to the patient, then it makes it a lot easier to get them on side over time. Some patients are correctly thinking along these lines anyway, and all they're really wanting us to do is to confirm their own suspicions. They don't want a lot more tests. And there is a term called somatic fixation, which can apply just as much to doctors as to patients. Ideally, then, making a diagnosis of functional illness is not one of exclusion after all tests have been done. It's part of the normal differential diagnosis. And of course, for each patient, there may have been some quite reasonable investigations done already, and if those have been negative, it does support the diagnosis.
Are there specific questions that can help to detect functional illness?
Well, my colleague, Dr. Brett Mann from Christchurch, has had an interest in better diagnostic skills and treatment for these patients. And for adults, at least, he's come up with four standard questions, which are, what was going on in your life around the time the symptoms started? And that can be anything like a new job or relationship issues or having your first child or whatever. Number two, are your symptoms ever related to pressure or responsibility or relationship issues or similar? And number three, are there times you do not have any symptoms or when your symptoms seem to be getting better, like immediately on waking or at night and weekends or holidays with exercise? And lastly, are there any times when you're always very likely to get symptoms? So we think these questions need to be quite standard ones as part of our normal history taking. Dr. Mann also summarised the usual patterns of functional illness, which are that symptoms are usually worse with pressure and busyness and responsibility and relationship challenges. Symptoms may also recur with minor day-to-day pressures, even if the initial situation has been resolved. Functional symptoms are usually absent in the night and first thing on waking, and they often do not fit the usual biomedical patterns. They may be highly atypical or unique, or a patient may have multiple symptoms in different organ systems.
Are there any patient characteristics that are more often associated with functional illness?
Well, there are some patient characteristics that are more associated with these presentations, and these include female gender, fewer years of education, lower socioeconomic status or other social stressors, history of childhood chronic illness, and I guess some personality types do seem to be a bit more at risk of these illnesses, such as anxiety, obsessiveness, being over-analytical or excessive body scanners. But this is not true for all patients, and you can't generalise too much on it. People with a history of sexual abuse or other childhood or adult trauma are more at risk, and those with concurrent medical disorders, especially in older patients, are also at risk. Those with concurrent psychiatric disorders are more prone to this, and the family history of chronic illness. So all these patients can be presenting with multiple comorbidities, which can make it very difficult actually to sort out any specific symptoms.
Are there any specific signs, criteria or questionnaires that can help with a diagnosis of functional illness?
Yes, as I mentioned before, there are useful criteria now for some of the chronic illnesses such as IBS and CFS and so on. And in most of these illnesses, there are in fact very few positive signs. The exception really is functional neurological disorders, or FND, where there are quite a few positive signs which are very helpful. For example, it is possible to differentiate non-epileptic seizures from epileptic seizures by the long duration of shaking episodes, asynchronous limb movements, pelvic thrusting, side-to-side head movements, closed eyes, crying, recall of what happened, and observing a functional tremor between events. An FND associated with weakness of, say, the leg, there's also a sign called Hoover's sign, which is based on involuntary synergistic contraction, and this test is usually positive. So in neurology, there are some useful clinical signs as well as the usual symptoms. In gait difficulties, for example, the symptoms can be observably reduced by distracting the patient and then demonstrating that by using their cell phone to observe them. In terms of questionnaires, I think if the patient has some degree of anxiety that might be contributing in some way, then it's useful to explore that further. The patient might have chronic hyperventilation or panic attacks or both. It's interesting that in both low-grade hyperventilation and in panic disorder, some patients may not recognise or acknowledge those underlying feelings of anxiety. So Brett Mann, for example, suggests that we need a low threshold for asking about frequent sighing or yawning, or that they can't get a deep enough breath, or feeling dizzy, lightheaded, get paresthesias, or their breathing feels very shallow, and so on. If these are present, then during the consultation, you can ask the patient to overbreathe or hyperventilate for a couple of minutes. If their symptoms start to emerge, then chronic hyperventilation might be contributing in some way. So this is the clinic hyperventilation test, and it can often be treated with breathing exercises or by seeing a physiotherapist. There's also the Nijmegen questionnaire for hyperventilation, where you get the patient to fill in either during the consultation or later, and this has a list of symptoms and scores from 0 to 4 for frequency. So this test is similar to the panic disorder questionnaire. A panic attack is the sudden feeling of intense fear or terror or feelings of impending doom that is not the result of real danger. And not surprisingly, symptoms are similar to hyperventilation, such as dizziness and shortness of breath and chest pain, discomfort, trembling and shaking. So a panic attack differs from feelings of fear and anxiety or worry that build up over time. Instead, it is the quick onset of extreme terror or fear. So this questionnaire lists more symptoms than hyperventilation, and there's lots more questions. And if what emerges is similar to their presenting complaint, then you've got the basis for making more effective interventions than if you didn't know about this going on in the background.
Can you describe a clinical scenario when a patient presented with symptoms that were consistent with a functional illness and how this diagnosis was arrived at?
There was a patient a few years ago who had chest pain and presented to ED with it. Not unreasonably, of course, for a first-time presentation, they did the usual ECG and enzymes, which are negative, so she was quite stable, so sent home. And on further discussion a few days later, she told me that she felt this was all just life. She had been very worried about her daughter, who was overseas and about to have a baby. She had hoped to be there to help, but her husband had taken ill and she had to postpone her trip. On further questioning, this situation was just ghastly for her. In her view, first-time mothers need their own mother there to help, especially in another country. So she admitted to having a terrible bout of anxiety at the same time as her chest pain. It seems likely in retrospect she had chest pain as part of a panic attack. So that diagnosis was made in retrospect, really, rather than at the time. In this case, the questions about hyperventilation were positive, and this was a very helpful realisation for her, as it confirmed her own self-diagnosis and also explained how she got those symptoms. So this diagnosis was actually made over time. Other patients, the diagnosis might be more apparent at the first presentation.
How do clinicians minimise the risk of missing an organ-based diagnosis if they are considering somatisation at the first presentation?
Well, I guess taking a good history and a good examination go a long way to sort out any differential diagnosis, which, as I have indicated, needs to include functional illness. And if you discover what you call red flags, such as blood in the bowel, or unintentional loss of weight, or night pain, or headache with vomiting, or specific clinical signs, such as loss of reflexes, or fever, or a new heart murmur, then clearly we are looking at other sorts of diseases. Unfortunately, most of us practicing doctors were not taught how to diagnose and treat these illnesses in medical school, so all these useful questions were not included in the normal approach to history taking and systems inquiry. Generally speaking, I don't think we've really developed the same thorough approach to psychosocial factors that might be triggering symptoms as we do with the causes of biomedical diseases. Now, some patients are insistent that they do have an organic illness and they really want you to carry on doing more investigations. They believe some physical reason as to why they have ongoing pain or other symptoms. I think we need to have a sort of prepared, clear statement in advance for this clinical situation, which might be along the lines of, yes, you do have a particular condition and we do recognise this now in medicine. And if it is one of the well-known syndromes such as CFS or FND or IBS, then you can look up the diagnostic criteria and illustrate those to the patient directly to see how their symptoms match the criteria so they don't need to be looking for another diagnosis. And you can also say, look, I'm sorry this can be quite a difficult diagnosis to get your head around, but hopefully with my explanation about what's happening and my support over time, you can expect to improve. And if the patient's starting to develop chronic pain or has had pain for some time, then you need to identify that clearly as such. That is, that their condition is one of chronic pain, which is usually not due to ongoing tissue damage, and it now requires a different mindset and approach. And for those patients, and also for those with their own particular or unique symptoms, you also need to say that their brainstem and neurophysiological pathways are a bit out of kilter at present, but with the right coaching, they can come right. So pattern recognition is what we use in medicine all the time, and these illnesses are no different in that regard to most other diseases. They have a pattern and a feel to them. And once you start to look and recognise these illnesses more readily, then you get better at it and better at being more comfortable with staying with the diagnosis and not requesting more tests, either due to pressure from the patient or from your own internal pressure not to miss something else.
What is your initial approach to the management of patients with functional illness?
Well, firstly, making a clear diagnosis and developing trust between doctor and patient need to be the initial starting points. And in order for the patient to trust the doctor must respect the patient and their personal history and their clinical story. You know, apart from drug-seeking patients and those with factitious disorder, which is an important psychiatric diagnosis, patients almost never make up their symptoms. They have symptoms for a wide range of reasons, but symptoms are not self-induced or under voluntary control. This means respecting that the patient has been doing the best they can given their background and experiences. Just to reiterate then, these sorts of symptoms do not imply psychological illness or weakness or a low pain threshold or that it's all in their head or that the patient is putting it on or making it up or the secondary gain or that it's the patient's fault in some way or the patient has mental illness. I believe that interpretations such as those by the doctor illustrate what is known as countertransference, which might be in relation to their own feelings of uncertainty or perhaps frustration. They are, of course, understandable responses, as we weren't trained to be effective or competent with these sorts of diagnoses. So once respect and trust are in place, then the task is one of holding the patient, or in other words, that you don't investigate further You get to know the patient as a person over time, then you can gradually educate about what's going on. I know it sounds a lot easier, of course, than it is in practice.
What are the general principles of management for these patients?
I think it's the overall package that is the most effective over time. You need to engage and reassure, to validate the patient's experience, and to offer your commitment to providing ongoing support and treatment. A firm positive diagnosis provides the patient with confidence that the practitioner knows what's going on. And like many other diseases such as asthma or diabetes, it is patient self-management that is the key to ongoing outcomes. So my list of principles includes engagement, that's reassurance, validation and commitment. And then education, which is to provide one or more of the explanatory models. I'm also keen on educating patients about general reduction of sympathetic system activation and increasing parasympathetic system. That's relaxation, breathing techniques, mindfulness, meditation, water therapy, which is baths and swimming, walks in the bush or on the beach and so on. In Japan, they call that forest bathing or bush bathing, which is really quite a lovely idea. And then there is pain education, which is an important specific education package. There's also specific visualization exercises, such as blocking the afferent nerve, that is the incoming pain or sensation, that can be overinterpreted by the brain stem. So diagrams are good for this, and patients often take up the challenge of figuring out their own block to the incoming pathways, so the cortex doesn't perceive it as pain. So my colleague John Dunbar is very adept at this sort of explanation for patients. One of his complex regional pain syndrome patients visualised their incoming nerve as a hose of water. So she figured out how to block the hose every time she felt the pain. This was quite quickly very effective in reducing her chronic pain. Identifying past beliefs and effective previous trauma might need to be attended to, so counselling for some patients might be needed as well. Now, I am a fan of reflective writing, as people can get considerable benefits. There's a good researcher in the US called James Pennebaker who wrote a brilliant article called Telling Stories, the Health Benefits of Narrative. For example, he divided volunteers into two groups to write for 15 minutes a day for 4 days. One group had to write about stressful experiences in their life, while the other had to simply describe their day or the room. And on follow-up over time, the traumatic writing group had significantly reduced their rates of attending health services compared to the control group. So this was an incredible outcome, which has since been replicated a number of times. For example, writing about stressful experiences in a structured way has been associated with symptom reduction in patients with asthma or rheumatoid. And actually, in an Auckland study on medical students, those students who were randomly assigned to write about their personal traumatic events showed higher antibody levels against hepatitis B at follow-up compared to the other control students who just wrote about their normal day. And in all those studies, no one actually had to read what they wrote. They could, of course, just throw it in the bin. It seems that such writing helps people to express something significant. They may not know what they wanted to say, but the writing process seems to help to get it out. So I don't push patients to do this. I just tell them anonymized stories about some of my other patients who did find that sort of writing helpful in some way. Self-management also includes general lifestyle modifications which promote health, such as exercise and regular sleep and good nutrition. And there is some evidence now that whole food, plant-based diets can be effective for conditions such as fibromyalgia and probably lots of other conditions, chronic conditions as well. So that's the overall package, which of course requires considerable engagement over time. Once again, my colleague John Dunbar has a similar list. That is to normalise and validate the symptoms, to show compassion, that pain is always pain, whether you find the cause or not, to consider the possibility that the brain has misinterpreted the incoming messages, to provide a conceptual model to help the patient understand why, how and why they have pain, and that really understanding is everything. This hands control back to the patient, and with the control, they can potentially help themselves to recover.
How important is it for the doctor to get to know the patient?
Well, I do think it can be more difficult these days to get to know the patient as a person. Unfortunately, it's quite common for patients to say, you know, see three different doctors in three different consultations. And this is both in primary care and in outpatients. I've always felt it takes me two or three consults to get to start to know the patient and their background and what's going on in their life and who's at home with them and so on. And having been a patient myself at times, I think it takes me 2 to 3 consults to start to trust a new doctor, or I'm more likely to accept their investigations and treatment on offer. So consulting different doctors means that it's much harder to build up what you might call cultural capital between the doctor and the patient. Having said that, specialists often have 45 minutes or even an hour on their first consultation, and in general practice, those short but regular consultations over time can help to build a trusting relationship where problems can be disclosed more gradually and a narrative can be created. But in both contexts with these more complex patients, the initial goal must be to learn who the patient actually is. This is because these illnesses can be a major disruption to the usual narrative of their life. Having chronic fatigue or complex regional pain syndrome can literally stop people in their tracks. They might have to put their study or their work or their play on hold. So this is a bit like Eric Cassell, who usefully identified how suffering impacts on the self of a person. And it is within the values and meanings of someone's life story that decisions about treatment need to be made. So these personal stories can be quite big. They suggest also that we need to have the capacity to just sit and hear and listen about personal suffering and loss and grief and trauma and so on. I think it takes time to learn how to do this, not trying to fix it, but just try to bear witness to people's suffering. And this can be tremendously helpful in itself for patients.
You've mentioned the importance of providing patients with explanations. What sort of explanations have you found helpful?
Well, without an explanation for their illness, patients can become frustrated and feel let down by the health system and seek alternative sources of treatment. So to prevent that, we need to provide patients with education and narratives that explain the symptoms and provide meaning. I think that different explanations are needed for different sorts of patients. So these include the brainstem and its role in inflammation, fight-flight responses in the modern world, which include instinctive responses and the physiology of feelings, and 3, the emotional links between mind and body. So the first one is the brainstem talk. These ideas arise from the work of John Dunbar and others. So basically, the brain has two parts, a conscious part and a subconscious or unconscious part. Technically, these bits are the cerebral cortex, where we think consciously, while the subconscious bit is the brainstem and medulla. This part of the brain controls almost all of our body functions. There's digestion, heart and lungs, muscle function, balance, and so on. Of course, we don't tell our stomachs to secrete acid when some food arrives or lift the proximal muscles of the leg when walking. And all the internal activities of the body, of course, carry on when we are asleep. Actually, I like to think of the brainstem as doing a sort of ongoing Jedi mind trick. It has been monitoring your blood sugar, which then gets down to 4 or so, and then it says, "You're getting hungry, you need to find some food." Then the cerebral cortex says, "Gee, I'm getting a bit hungry, I might go and look in the fridge for a bite to eat," and so on. So this is happening all the time. So the brainstem filters all incoming information before that actually reaches our consciousness. If we get an injury, for example, the stimulus usually goes straight to the brainstem. Then after input from several other centres in the brain, like the memory centre, it is then perceived as pain or some other sensation, depending on how it's been filtered and processed. So previous experience of injury may predicate how the brainstem perceives the next one. Basically then, the brainstem is in control. It lets us know about stuff, but only on a needs-to-know basis, and it acts in our best interests without asking us in advance. So this is hugely important. The time the brainstem does tend to overdo this a bit, which can be a bit of a problem, and in fact it can get it wrong at times, sometimes like in chronic pain. One way that the brainstem acts in our best interest is the physiological response to injury or infection. And usually in response to one of those, you can get an acute inflammatory response, increased blood flow, fluid and swelling, even pus at times, which is the white cells being mobilised. So these responses can be both local in the injured area, and as well as involving the whole body, like in a good going viral infection where you get a major systemic inflammatory response, including temperature and generalized pain and generalized muscle weakness. You can't think clearly, sort of a brain fog and so on. That's not the virus doing all those things, it's the body's inflammatory response to infection that so disables us. Interestingly, I just had surgery on my hand recently. I was a bit surprised by the amount of weakness of my hand, which felt out of proportion to the wound. I then remembered that the inflammatory response is centrally controlled as part of the brainstem being in charge, so it was making sure that I rested the arm so the wound would heal. In general then, the pain and disability is more that we feel is more from the inflammatory response than the original wound. You could say there's sort of a button that turns on the inflammatory response, and once the wound has healed, that button turns it off again. But if the brainstem overdoes it, then you might have a sort of a hypersensitive or an oversensitive button, which seems to be what's going on with complex regional pain syndrome, for example. There is an inappropriate local reaction. The patients get ongoing swelling and redness and pain and weakness and so on in their knee or whatever, or wherever, all out of proportion to the original minor injury. The brainstem also gets input from lots of other parts of the brain as well. For example, the perception of pain is dependent on the context of the injury, previous experience of other injuries, and the pain is usually worse when you're tired and stressed and so on. The perception of pain depends on who that person is. Their personal and cultural beliefs, attitudes and so on have influence. But none of this is voluntary. It's all controlled at an unconscious level by the brainstem and medulla. So when you're explaining all this to patients, it's very useful to use diagrams, which need to be schematic rather than strictly anatomical. It's not so important to be technically accurate, but that the patient can understand the idea that these neurophysiological pathways function below their self-awareness. In chronic fatigue, just as an example, perhaps the systemic inflammatory button has become too sensitive, so in response to even very minor physical exertion, you get this major response of fatigue and generalized pain and generalized muscle weakness. Patients can't think clearly, a sort of a brain fog and so on. For some patients, it's like a major viral reaction, but without the virus being present. And as I mentioned, it's our inflammatory response that so disables us, not the triggering factor. I have found it useful to use migraine as an illustrative example, as most patients know someone who gets quite disabled by migraine. Of course, migraine is not really considered to be a functional illness, but it seems to me to have the same underlying physiological processes as other syndromes that have not been awarded the status of a clearly defined disease. In migraine, there's a sudden narrowing and then an opening of a cerebral artery, which then causes pain and vomiting and photophobia and so on. So it's clearly a problem with the autonomic system, which I'll talk about soon. And typically of these syndromes, all the investigations are negative, as it's not a problem of structure, but one of how the arteries are functioning. Now in migraine, there's lots of triggers such as bright or flashing lights and sun glare and loud sounds and strong smells and wine or coffee and stress at work or home, which can be acute or unresolved or chronic. There's missing sleep and jet lag and physical exertion and weather and hormones and medications and cheese and chocolate and so on. But despite the actual trigger, the pain and vomiting almost always end up being exactly the same. So migraine then is quite well viewed as a well-developed brainstem to neurophysiological pathway. It does not involve thinking about it, patients can't prevent it happening, and it's difficult to turn it off once started. And of course, patients can't turn one on at will. My understanding is that many of these other syndromes are also very similar. The mechanism is a pathophysiological process that comes on in bouts, triggered by a range of factors. In complex regional pain syndrome, it seems that the button for regional inflammatory processes gets switched on unnecessarily. As another example, recurrent symptoms such as throat or bladder inflammation, but without infection found, might be the inflammatory button firing again, even if there are no bacteria present. So once those pathways become well developed, it doesn't take a lot to fire them off. Usually in chronic pain there's no structural damage, but the brainstem might still be responding with inflammation, or perhaps the brainstem is overinterpreting any incoming stimulus and sending it up to the cerebral cortex, which is then perceived as pain. So the value of this explanation is that it helps patients understand what can be quite mysterious. It also validates them. They're not making it up. It's not all in their head. It's just their brainstem behaving a bit oddly. The key message is to provide a conceptual model that explains how our mind and body work and how pain and other sensations can occur. It needs to be plausible, but it doesn't need to be medically exact. Just use terms that make sense to the patient. And it can help with what to do next, which I'll come to in a minute. One idea being to consciously reprogram those nerve pathways.
Is the fight-flight physiological response useful for explaining some of these symptoms?
Well, the second way the brainstem looks after us without asking permission first is through the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. These body systems evolve to keep us safe from danger, like from the tiger or being attacked by other tribes. These two systems are included in every single neurovascular bundle to every artery and every organ of the body. And like all homeostatic systems, they act as a mutual balancing system. So in acute danger, your breathing, heart rate and blood pressure are increased in order to deliver oxygen and blood to the muscles to run or fight. However, at the same time, blood flow is actually reduced to the digestive tract and peripheries and skin and immune systems, which really aren't needed in acute danger. And once the danger has passed and all these changes are switched off by the parasympathetic system, that's when we heave a sigh of relief and relax and we realise just how dangerous that situation was. So that's how it's supposed to work. The trouble is, in the modern world, our dangers are not so acute or immediate, and nor are they switched off so readily. So in low-grade stress, there's often a chronic increase in blood flow and general input to the cardiovascular system and respiratory and muscle systems. And not surprisingly, people have increased heart rates and palpitations like ectopics and blood pressure, and they might also have hyperventilation issues and respiratory problems such as asthma and muscle tension and muscle pain and trigger points and enthesis and so on, all symptoms that you could say are low-grade over-excitation of the body getting ready to run. And the drawback of reducing blood flow and innervation to those other non-essential fighting bits is that their normal functioning and homeostasis is reduced. You know, that's the digestive system and reproductive systems and immunity and skin and hair and nails and so on. So they have reduced function. They might be impaired in some way. So it's not surprising then that in low-grade chronic stress, people get indigestion and pain and diarrhea and constipation and wind and mucus in the GI tract, or menstrual cycle changes or sexual dysfunction, impotence, and so on. More prone to shingles and such as an infection, or they get dry skin and eczema and so on. There's a useful book along these lines by Sapolsky called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And he talks about the difference between episodic acute stress and chronic low-grade stress. Turns out that zebras are either grazing okay or else running away from the tiger. So once they've stopped running away from the tiger, they immediately relax. So zebras are happy, 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 and then dead, or else they're back to grazing. So their acute adrenergic reactions are full on and then fully turned off. But they don't worry, 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 like we tend to do about the past or about the future, which then leads to an ulcer. What I'm suggesting here is that low-grade firing of the adrenergic system without regular switching off by the parasympathetic system will often cause us to have some symptoms, even if the patient is relatively unaware of the underlying tensions and stressors. So one way to link those symptoms to the underlying bodily physiology is to look at what happens in a full-blown panic attack. As I've mentioned, panic attack is a sort of uncoordinated fight or flight response, and there can be symptoms in almost all systems of the body. And these tell us what their body system does when the sympathetic system goes overboard. So the whole list is quite long. It includes breathing problems and choking or smothering sensations and heart pounding, chest pain, rapid heartbeat, feeling faint, dizzy, vertigo, unsteady, feelings of unreality, difficulty concentrating, fear of doing something uncontrolled, fear of going crazy, fears of death or serious illness. Then there's acute neck pain and neck tension and headache and joint pain, trembling and shaking, cold extremities, hot and cold flashes, ringing in the ears, tingling in the hands or feet, nausea, blurred vision, ears ringing, sweating and so on, which cover most of the body really. And clinically, for example, if these symptoms mostly coalesce around the cardiovascular system, then it can be tricky to differentiate it from a major cardiac event, as is often chest pain as well. So even if the patient is not having major panic attacks, their symptoms might be related in some way to overfiring of the sympathetic system. This does not mean to say they're not coping. It's more their brainstem is just doing its job in response to perceived or even unconscious recognition of danger in some way. It's also instructive to illustrate how these brainstem neurophysiological pathways are working all the time on a day-to-day basis. I like the idea of using our instinctive responses to danger, which occur before we've had time to think about it consciously. I'm thinking of our startle response to an unexpected loud noise. the usual unhealthy fear of heights, or instantaneous revulsion or even nausea at the sight of rotten food. So these are instinctive responses to stimuli that signify danger. They're brainstem automatic responses which are designed to keep us safe from harm. They don't involve thinking about it, as that would take a bit too long. We can't prevent them happening, although we can habituate over time, and they're difficult to turn off once started. We often feel emotions at the same time or a bit later, but those responses are necessarily instantaneous, not in response to the feeling. They illustrate the brainstem's role to act quickly. For example, getting sweaty armpits and a racing heart before an exam or public speaking, the heart skipping a beat, or fainting at the sight of blood. Interestingly, shivering with cold or shivering in anticipation are the same physiological responses. It seems that the neurophysiological pathway to shivering can be triggered by different stimuli. And some people also feel shivers running up their spine or the hairs on their neck starting to crawl, which is apparently localized micro-shivering in relation to particular emotional states. And there are many other physiological correlates with strong emotions, such as grief and anger and so on. Shedding tears can be in response to both sadness and joy, and there's nervous diarrhea and loose bowels in relation to upcoming challenges. So these sorts of explanations can help patients to acknowledge the links between their current lives, which inevitably generate various body states and body processes, which are not under their voluntary control. Some patients don't recognize or feel the usual accompanying feelings. They just get the symptoms, like increased peristalsis or loose bowel motions or ectopics or whatever. So to translate to clinical issues, abdominal pain, constipation, diarrhea, mucus, and irritable bowel syndrome, for example, is likely to be related to uncoordinated bowel spasms, perhaps part of reduced homeostatic control of the GI tract. And once such a pathway has been developed, then many other triggers, such as various foods, can set it off. Fibromyalgia is perhaps overstimulation regionally of the musculoskeletal system. Once set in place, can also be hard to turn off.
You have mentioned emotional links between mind and body. Can you explain this a little more?
So Brett Mann's four standard questions are useful clues that there are feelings and emotions involved in some way. Just to recap then, they are: what was going on in your life around the time the symptoms started? Are your symptoms ever related to pressure or responsibility and so on? Are the times you do not have the symptom, and are the times when you are very likely to get the symptoms? So these questions usually indicate underlying personal or life or work stressors that the person is attempting to manage. Actually, I try not to use the word stress, as for many people, that word implies that they're not coping. I usually wait till I hear their word for such a thing, such as a pressure or a hassle or stuff on my plate or life going on or similar, then use that word or phrase. Stress is also a surface description, but not necessarily very accurate to what's really going on for the patient in terms of the impact on them as a person and what they're actually feeling, such as fear or sadness or envy or betrayal or loneliness, loss of identity or whatever. Then to elicit this, you need to provide some space for patients to tell you what life is actually like for them. Sometimes just telling their story is sufficient in itself, and sometimes they make their own links between what's going on and their symptoms. An endocrinologist called Clifton Meador wrote a fascinating book called Symptoms of Unknown Origin, and being a super specialist in the US, he had access to every investigation known at the time and then some, and after years of investigating many of these patients, he came up with some quite interesting categories. These weren't based on the symptoms of various organ systems, but on their self-awareness about their own feelings and their links to their life. So Group 1 patients then are aware of their own feelings and are willing to explore links to what's happening in their life at the time. They are the patients who come along and say, "Doc, I have these pains, but I reckon they're just my body reacting to my current work situation." So your job, of course, is to do a thorough history and exam to rule out any red flags and to make your own mind up about that and to see if it's in fact the case. After some explanations, groups 2 and 3 will accept such links between life and symptoms or mind and body, and they generally go well. However, group 4 patients may have much less awareness of their own feelings. They may seem relatively unconnected to what's actually going on, and they may be quite unwilling to explore it. And these are often the thick folder patients or Hutsing patients with long-standing or multiple problems, often very somatically fixated and wanting more tests, even though your instinct is clearly that they won't help. This can be a very difficult group with complex past stories and life narratives. The main thing is not to make them worse by doing further tests or surgery and simply sort of holding them as much as possible and to eventually hear their story, painful as that may be sometimes. But the principles of treatment are same for all groups, validating their symptoms as being real, reassuring them that their symptoms do not mean they're weak or not coping, slow and careful education using some of the models I've listed, normalising that everyone has symptoms in times of pressure or workload, and then coaching on relaxation and meditation and so on to increase parasympathetic system firing, and even perhaps to suggest reflective writing to increase their own self-awareness.
Are there any resources that patients with functional illness might find helpful?
Well, there's lots of resources out there at the moment, such as informational websites and apps and community groups, and some of these are listed in the text beside this podcast. Just as two examples, Brian Broom from Auckland developed the Whole Person Healthcare website with many resources for both clinicians and patients, including the Illness Explorer, where patients can do their own research into their symptoms as a sort of a self-educational tool. More specifically, in terms of functional neurological disorders, John Stone's website from Edinburgh is useful for both patients and clinicians, and it's called neurosymptoms.org. In terms of community-based workshops for patients, Mel Abbott is an NLP practitioner based in Auckland and runs four-day workshops based on education and stress reduction techniques. And just as another example in the UK, Phil Parker runs what's called the Lightning Process. And there's many testimonials from patients from all these groups who have benefited, which is probably from well-structured group work and the use of modern neuroscience to provide explanations and ways forward. There are also quite a few apps out there now, and the one that gets quite good press is called Curable. They have four modules that people can work their way through on their own, such as pain education, meditation, reflective writing, and specific brain training. It was developed by neuroscientists and clinicians and patients, and it seems to me to be quite sound based on the usual interventions that increase self-awareness, activating the parasympathetic system and resilience. Interestingly, it was originally intended for those with chronic pain, but people with other long-standing illnesses such as chronic fatigue syndrome are also finding the modules to be helpful. So I suspect again it's the overall package that's effective rather than one single intervention. These resources also illustrate the importance of patient self-management and also the need to be sufficiently motivated to do this sort of work. Many patients seem to gain considerable self-efficacy, even if not the whole cure.
Can medical students be trained to have more specific skills in this area of clinical practice?
Well, medical students do receive occasional teaching from interested clinicians on some of these illnesses. At the moment, however, student learning about the generic challenges posed by functional illness is not really integrated within a coherent curriculum with clear learning outcomes. And consequently, much of their learning is through what is known as the hidden curriculum, where students tend to absorb the attitudes and behaviours of practicing doctors, and unfortunately many of whom have had no specific training for these particular patients. Just to give you an example, at the moment, training at Otago for consultation skills is based on the Calgary-Cambridge model. This has been very helpful to identify specific communication skills, and it includes questions about the illness experience and so on. We would like those questions to include Brett Mann's ones, like what was going on in your life at the time the symptoms started? Are your symptoms ever related to pressure or work and so on? So that symptoms are then considering functional illness as part of normal history taking. And then as part of patient management, students could also be coached on how to reassure patients that they're having symptoms does not mean to say they're not coping, how to normalise many symptoms as something that everyone can have in times of stress or pressure, and coaching on how to advise patients on relaxation and mindfulness and meditation and healthy nutrition and so on. And taking this further, most medical schools provide workshops on motivational interviewing for smoking or lifestyle change, how to break bad news and so on. Students could also be taught how to explain the fight-flight response to patients and the emotional links between mind and body and neurophysiological pathways and how to teach patients about visualization and so on. So I guess these comments about student training also illustrate what was lacking for most of us current clinicians. Instead, we had to learn all these skills by ourselves by trial and error. We weren't given much positive role modelling from clinicians at the time. It will take a while, of course, for any sort of revised undergraduate training to produce medical graduates with new skills. So in the meantime, registrars in general practice and in other specialties need specific training about these illnesses. So in my view, their courses need to allocate quite a bit of time for this. And I remember Pat Farry, one of my earlier mentors, calling this a sort of a retraining for general practice. In the UK, research on student learning has illustrated how students can acquire negative attitudes to these patients with, say, chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. Students have interpreted the absence of formal teaching as meaning those conditions have a low priority. There has been no research so far on student learning in New Zealand, but we're hoping to address that quite soon. I think it'd be fascinating to take a sort of a snapshot of final year students' current knowledge and attitudes about FS and lifestyle interventions, identifying what they've learned as they near the end of their training. We could also interview clinical teachers to compare the students and the knowledge and the teachers' knowledge and skills. We know that patients with FS, for example, are often over-investigated or over-treated with inappropriate medications or surgery. So I think students also need specific training about medical uncertainty and how to reuse those resources more wisely and judiciously.
Finally, where do you think medical practice might be heading with these clinical issues?
Well, there have been many occasions where advances in a field occurred when scientists looked outside their current framework. I think we can learn a lot from others, especially those one-off case reports or remarkable recoveries after years of pain and disability. Surely there's a research project to see there to see if there are common elements and what was actually effective after years of suffering and of searching. I think in medicine we can learn a lot from the emerging fields of modern neuroscience and NLP and positive psychology, which are more based on resiliency models perhaps than the sort of deficit model we've been more used to. The trick will be to translate those ideas into normal medical practice. Actually, I'm optimistic that we will take some major leaps forward in this area of clinical medicine over the next 10 or so years. This can only be a good thing for our patients. It will also be a very good thing for us as clinicians, as those patients may no longer be seen as mysterious or, at worst, challenging to our sense of self as a doctor. And having confidence in ourselves and our skill set for every sort of patient will clearly be a good thing for everyone. So thanks very much, Mark, for the opportunity to talk on these topics.